"Yes, sir, I recognise her for sure."
"What is she?"
"Humbug, sir," said the midshipman, in a rather hesitant roar. Jack could not believe he had heard aright.
"What did you say?" he cried.
"Humbug, sir."
And from the bows came a peal of honest mirth, while within arm's reach of the captain, three young gentlemen writhed in an effort to contain themselves, and all the officers were on the grin. It was a current Baltic joke, but one that newcomers could not know. Just before the Russians joined the Allies, a facetious captain of the Royal Navy had captured one of their vessels, a very distinctive tyne-built hermaphrodite, a fine sailor on a bowline, and he had changed her impossible Russian name to this, the only humbug ever known or likely to be known in the Navy list. Humbug, by God! The word had been used to him, publicly, on his own quarter-deck. The boy must be drunk. For a moment Jack's face took on a most forbidding look, and the grins died away, but then his pomp, his righteous indignation, dissolved, and he said,
"Very well, Mr. Jevons. You will stay there till I call you."
He gazed at the Minnie. She was jammed in a clinch like Jackson.
"Let us take in the skysail, Mr. Hyde," he said. "There is no point in endangering the mast."
He was convinced that he could give the Minnie royals on this tack, and even the fatigallant, and still lay her aboard within the hour. He would not have to use his bow-chasers.
"Yes, sir," said Mr. Hyde. "No, sir. No point at all. And by the way, sir, the hermaphrodite really is called Humbug. Jevons meant no disrespect."
"Is that so? Well, well, then he may come down again. Where is the signal midshipman? To Humbug, since that is her name, enemy in sight, chase to east-south-east, and give her a gun. Mr. Jagiello, I am sorry they knocked you down. You are all right now, are you not?"
"Oh, perfectly well, sir," said Jagiello, laughing. "It was nothing at all. My spurs caught in the rope. I believe I shall take them off."
"I beg your pardon, sir," said Mr. Pellworm, "but she is heading for the Foughton Bank. Indeed, she is almost on the tail of the Kraken already, if I do not mistake."
"Is she, though?"
cried Jack. The Foughton was a series of shoals a few miles off the flat, sandy shore, and its winding channel was very little frequented. The Minnie, riding light, would draw 2 feet less water than the Ariel. Her hope, her last hope, was to lead her pursuer over a bank where the Minnie would pass and the Ariel stick tight. That was one of the reasons for her sudden turn.
"The Fox! Light along the lead there. Mr. Pellworm, can you carry us through?"
"I believe so, sir,"
said Pellworm, glancing significantly at the vast spread of canvas overhead.
"Then she is yours. Reduce sail as soon as you please."
The sun dipped. The pink sails came in one by one. The Ariel fetched them in his wake and glided along, no longer gaining, with the lead going on either side, and the pilot, grave and concentrated at the con, now fixing his sea marks, a tower on the shore and a distant spire with his azimuth compass, now staring at the ship ahead to catch the least motion of her helm. It moved often as she pursued her dog-legged course, apparently quite at home. With a 15-minute interval, the Ariel's rudder made the same motion as she glided over the seemingly innocent sea in the twilight. It was a strange procession. All the flying speed and excitement was gone, replaced by quite a different tension. Her bower anchors were ready, a cockbill at the catheads, with a kedge at the stern davits and hands stationed to let them go at the word. There was silence, fore and aft, not a sound but the pilot's orders and the leadsman's chant.
"By the deep, six. By the deep, six. By the mark, five. And a half, five."
And so it went, until the leadsman's voice rose in a sharp emphasis,
"And a half, three. And a half, three."
To a man the Ariels pursed their lips. Precious little water under them now.
"Peck the foretopsail," called the pilot, taking the wheel. "And a half, three. By the mark, three. A quarter less, five. By the deep, six. And a half, six."
They were in the deep channel once more. Jack breathed out at last. Water under his keel, thank God. But the Minnie was turning again, turning 3 points to starboard. There was ugly stuff coming, for sure. He must not worry the pilot, but, Lord, how he longed.
"She's struck!"
came a bellowing mooncalf roar from the bows.
"She's grounded herself, the bloody old father-lasher! Ho, ho!"
A quartermaster choked him short. A midgetman beat him with a speaking trumpet, but what he said was true. The Minnie came gently to a halt in the sea. All her masts gave an easy lean forwards, and then a most furious lean as her captain dropped and sheeted home all his clued-up sails in an attempt at driving her over the bank. A vain attempt, nor could he back her off. She was held fast, lying there on an even keel, as motionless as though she were moored head and stern. More so, since she did not even rock.
"Briskly with the lead there!" cried Jack. "Can you lay her alongside, Mr. Pellworm?"
"Close on, sir," said the pilot, chuckling.
"But a mark seven," chanted the leadsman. "And a half seven."
"This is the Kraken Channel," observed Mr. Pellworm. "Stand by the kedge."
The Minnie was coming nearer, nearer and nearer. Her people's faces could be seen, white blobs in the twilight, their voices heard. They were launching a boat over the stern, a little gig. Jack saw uniformed figures on her deck. French officers, without a doubt.
"That will do, Mr. Pellworm," he said, within a cable's length of the immobile chase.
He did not wish the boat to be masked by the ship for any length of time. He did not wish to come too close, spoiling his line of fire.
"Let go the kedge. Let go the best power. Rail up. Clue up."
He took a speaking trumpet and hailed,
"Minnie, hoist in that boat, or I shall blow you out of the water."
No response, but a furious altercation and a pistol shot aboard the chase.
"Mr. Jagiello," he called. "Pray hail them in Danish and repeat what I said. Mr. Hyde, a spring to the cable."
Jagiello shouted the message high and clear over the 200 yards of sea, shouted it in different languages. The boat splashed down into calm water. The French officers jumped into it, and at the same moment, as though by an afterthought, the Minnie struck her colours. The boat vanished along her starboard side.
"Quarters!"
said Jack, and in a moment the gun crews were at their stations. The guns themselves had been run out long ago.
"Mr. Hyde, three quarters on, then full."
The aerial turned on her spring, then steadied, almost as firm as the Minnie. When the boat reappeared, crossing the Minnie's stem and pulling inexpertly for the land, it was directly in the starboard bow chaser's line of fire. Another turn of the capstan would bring the whole broadside to bear, and at point-blank range. From a steady platform, an unmoving ship, a crew far less skilled than the aerials could scarcely miss.
"Mr. Nuttall," he said to the gunner, "single round shot and pitch it beyond them."
The gunner laid his piece, fired. The ball struck 50 yards beyond the boat in a true line and went skipping across the sea in a series of enormous bounds. The boat rowed on.
"Again?" said Jack.
This time the smoke obscured the fall of the shot, but as it cleared, there was the boat still heading for the shore.
"Full on, Mr. Hyde," said Jack, in a harsh voice.
It was a sickening business, but his carronades would not reach much farther, and no single gun could be perfectly relied upon. He must get it over at once. The ship was broadside on, the gun crews poised about their carronades.
"From forward aft," he said, "deliberate fire. Wait for the smoke to clear. Fire one!"
The first shot pitched a little wide. The second rocked the boat, and in the eddying smoke he saw a man stand up. Was he waving a handkerchief? In the split second of his thought, the third gun fired, striking the boat fair and square. Planks flew up, and something like an arm. A savage cheer all along the deck, and the gun crews turned their beaming faces, clapping one another on the back.
"How's your guns?" said Jack. "Cutters away. Mr. Fenton, see if there are any survivors. Mr. Hyde, take possession of the prize and make the master lighten her at once. Anderson will interpret for you. Mr. Grimmond, a light in the maintop to guide the Humbug, and rouse out an 8-inch hawser. We must heave her off at once. There is not a minute to be lost."
Every minute was indeed irreplaceable, yet they flowed away by the score and by the hundred. The Minnie would not move. The channels were so narrow, the navigation so intricate, that a vessel of aerial's draught could not move with any freedom, could not take up a proper station. With infinite labour they laid out anchors by means of the launch, dragging the heavy cables behind them, and every time the capstan turned, taking the full strain and transmitting it to the Minnie, the anchors came home again. The situation was already difficult by the time Fenton returned with the one survivor, a youth of about 17, wounded in the leg and head, unconscious. It was far more complicated some time later when Stephen came up from the sick bay. There were ropes leading in every direction, stretching out into the darkness. In the glow of the lantern, the faces of the men at the capstan bars looked worn and jaded, all excitement gone. Jack had just finished a roared series of instructions to some distant boat when Stephen appeared.
"How does he come along?"
he asked in a hoarse voice.
"I believe we may save him," said Stephen. "The ligature seems to hold, and the young are wonderfully resilient. You seem in a sad way, brother."
"Tolerably so, tolerably so. Her after bits gave way, and we've lost our small bower, parted at the ring. But it could be worse. And I dare say Humbug will be here presently. She don't draw more than a few feet."
He sounded cheerful, and in fact the incessant activity kept the surface of his mind from brooding on the prospect of the hours ahead. But at no great depth he was aware that dirty weather was brewing in the north, that the Humbug, creeping over the shoals from the other side, creeping over the far extremity 5 miles away, had missed the channel and had already grounded twice, and that if anything of a sea got up, he should be obliged to slip his cables and run, abandoning the Minnie and perhaps the whole enterprise, so promising not long ago.
"Were you able to get anything out of him?"
"I was not," said Stephen. "He is in a deep coma. But I am afraid his uniform has nothing of the aide-de-camp's glory about it at all, and his letters are those of an ordinary subaltern. Besides, such a wild dash was surely the act of boys, rather than of sober, reflecting senior officers."
"I don't know," said Jack. "If I had command of a place like Grimsholm, I think I might have tried it. I think I might have tried for a horse on shore. It is not many hours' ride. But I'm very certain that I should have pulled away on the blind side for a mile or two. What is it, Mr. Rowbottom?" "If you please, sir, the spear anchor is new puddened." "Very good, very good. Then bend the bitter end to it. The bitter end, Mr. Rowbottom."
"Oh, yes, sir. The bitter end it is."
The second lieutenant came for fresh instructions, and while the urgent technical talk flowed past his ears, Stephen watched the lights far over the bank, the lights of all aerials and Minnie's boats busy about the radiating arms of rope that were to pull her off. Of all the boats, except the gig, which was carrying Pellworm away to the distant Humbug, to bring her in through the devious channels. A small, dismal rain began to fall, veiling the lights. Fenton ran aft, and Stephen said,
"But if I may have a word with the Minnie's captain, we may learn all there is to be learned. I must speak to him in any event to hear what he has to say about Grimsholm. I understand that the Minnie goes there from time to time."
"As soon as we have a boat free, I will send for him," said Jack.
And raising his voice, he called,
"Mr. Hyde, tell the Minnie's master to stand by to come across in the next boat. He is to bring the ship's papers, too."
"Sir,"
came Hyde's reply out of the wet darkness,
"the Frenchman pistoled him. Shall I send his mate?"
Two dim, wet figures came to report. An unseen boat hailed to say that the warp was entangled in a sunken wreck.
"Never fret your spirit now, my dear," said Stephen. "It would advance us nothing at this stage to know whether General Mercier is living or dead. Tomorrow morning would answer very well, so it would."
A violent, rending sound, a confusion of voices in the darkness, and Jack disappeared. Stephen waited, and then, the rain increasing, he went down to his cot, where he lay staring at the candle flame in his lantern, his hands behind his head. Physically, he was tired, and his body relaxed throughout its entire length. His mind was in much the same state, floating free, detached, as though he had taken his old favourite, the tincture of laudanum. He felt no particular anxiety. The attempt must either succeed or fail. He hoped with all his heart for success, but all his heart did not amount to a great deal now that some essential part of its core seemed to have died. Yet on the other hand he felt more able to command success in that it meant no less to him, to command it with a strength that arose not indeed from a fundamental indifference to his own fate, but from something resembling it that he could not define. It had a resemblance to despair, but a despair long past, with the horror taken out of it. The Humbug came through the fairway late in the middle watch, having had to fetch a long cast to windward, beating up tack upon tack. She brought the growing breeze with her, and the threat of a dirty end to the night. The lantern swung wider in the small, silent cabin. Stephen slept on. For the next hour and more, the Hermaphrodite laid out anchors and buoys. The ablest seamen in all three vessels spliced cables end to end. The cables ran through the hawse holes until there were none left in the tiers, and gradually the whole series of purchases, designed either to pluck the Minnie from her bed or to tear her guts out, took form. Stephen woke to the sound of a familiar voice raised high, so high that it pierced the deck, for now the whole system was to be put to the test, and now the strain was on, a strain divided between four anchors, nearly a mile of cables and hawsers, and all concentrated on the aerial's capstan.
"Stamp and go!" cried Jack to the hands at the bars. "Stamp and go! Heave! Heave her round! Heave hearty there!"
By now most of the men were minnies pressed into the present service. Though they might not understand the actual words, the gist was plain enough. They could scarcely gain an inch as they heaved, and the brisk clicking of the pawls faded steadily to no more than a click a minute, and then to none. Now the full force was on. The cable between the two ships showed never a curve as it vanished into the faint but growing light.
"Heave and rally! Heave! Heave and rally! Bosun, start that man! Heave and pawl! Well, fare ye, my lads! Now heave with a will!"
A distant cry.
"She stirs!"
The bars moved. The gasping men advanced half a step. The capstan turned. Turned faster.
"Well, fare ye! Heave and away!" cried Jack.
The Minnie slid stern first from her bank, gliding into deep water where she lay rocking easy, and half a dozen hands collapsed at the bars. Stephen dozed off for a time, while innumerable ropes of all sizes were recovered and stowed away. He heard a last cry of,
"Spice the main brace!"
and sank far down into sleep. It was full day when he woke. The rain had stopped, and the Minnie was alongside, receiving the Ariel's wine and tobacco. Far, far astern, the Humbug could be seen sweeping for the lost small bower. All hands, apart from the spry and cheerful Jagiello, looked somewhat bleary, but none so bleary as a glum, middle-aged man in a sheepskin cap with books under his arm, who was pointed out to Stephen as the Minnie's first mate.
"Mr. Jagiello," said Stephen, "I'm just about to visit my patient. When I come back, and I do not expect to be long, may I ask you to be so kind as to desire that man to come downstairs, to your cabin, if you please? With your help, I should like to ask him some questions."
The visit was indeed quite brief. The young man was still in his coma, looking little more than a child, in spite of his carefully trained, nascent moustache. He was breathing easily, deeply, and the surgery seemed successful so far. At least the delicate ligature had held, and would hold now. But Stephen had a keen sense of approaching death, and he believed he felt it now. There was nothing he could do at present, and he walked back to Jagiello and the mate. The questions were asked. Who were the French officers in the boat? What were the signals used for approaching Grimsholm? What were the formalities of landing? But little response did they obtain. The mate took refuge in ignorance and forgetfulness. This was his first voyage in the Minnie. He knew nothing of Grimsholm. He had never seen the Frenchmen. He did not remember anything about them.
"I think I shall leave this sullen fellow for a while," said Stephen, looking at the Minnie's muster-roll. "A period of recollection may make him more amenable. At present he is lying, mechanically and doggedly lying. The roll shows that he has been in the vessel for a year and 4 months. And in any case I yearn for the coffee I smell at no great distance. Will you accompany me?"
"Thank you," said Jagiello, "but I have already had my morning draught in the gun-room."
To his surprise, Stephen found Jack already at table, shaved, pink, and eating voraciously.
"Are you not abed yet, for all love?" he cried.
"Oh, I took a cat-nap in Draper's chair," said Jack. "It sets you up amazingly. Have a beefsteak."
"I thank you, Jack, but a cup of coffee and a piece of toast would answer very well for the moment. I mean to go back to the prisoner very soon. I have thought of a means of confounding the stupid creature. But first, let me congratulate you on having refloated the Minnie. A noble feat, upon my word."
"It was the tide that turned the day," said Jack.
You would hardly credit that a few miserable inches, and it is no more in the Baltic, you know, could have such an effect. But it gave just that trifle of lift at the very moment we needed it. Another half hour, and I should have had to slip and run. It was nip and tuck, I do assure you. But tell me, what news of the French officers? And what news of the young fellow? How does he do?
Stephen shook his head. He is still in his deep coma, he said, and I fear I may have been too sanguine last night. The mechanical processes function well enough, and the ligature has held, but the spirit is on the wing, perhaps. However, I hope to learn something about his companions directly. He carried his coffee back to Jagiello, and once again there was a surprise for him. Something had happened during his absence. The young man had the pleased, slightly mad look of an Apollo, a primitive Apollo, who has just made a neat job of Marsyas, whereas the captive was so pale that his lips showed yellow.
"He has told me quite a lot," said Jagiello, as he set a chair for Stephen and put a cushion in it. "And now he is speaking the truth. He really does not know who the French officers were, because they stayed in the cabin all the time. In principle the ship was bound for Bornholm, but they could easily have put into Grimsholm on the same voyage. Only the Minnie's captain would have known just where he meant to touch. He did see them when they were launching the boat, and he says they were not old. But that proves nothing. A French colonel or even a general might be quite young. As for Grimsholm, he knows there is a private signal, and the last time the Minnie was there it was a Hamburg Jack upside down on the front mast. But it might have changed since then. Only the captain would know. And then he says no one is ever allowed to land. They must stop at a little island near the shore, present their papers at the wharf, and unload by boats. They talk only to the French, who receive their papers. The little island is at the bottom of the bay, and it has a landing place, a wharf. It is the third of such islands. Draw, incest, he said to the Dane.
Stephen took the drawing and considered it.
Come, he said, let us check these statements with the more prudent, responsible members of the Minnie's crew, and allow me to observe, Mr. Jagiello, that a gold piece, decently proffered, will often obtain the best intelligence, and that the prospect of more in the event of success may elicit a flood of information untainted by concealed malignity. What we have here is very well, very specious, but believe me, I should not move an inch upon it without confirmation.
Jack was still eating, but slowly now, when Stephen returned to the cabin. He had appeared briefly on deck when the loading of the prize was completed, had observed that the wind was steady in the west-northwest, and had given orders that her own people, with a competent guard of marines, should sail the Minnie under the lee of the Ariel and her guns to give his own men a rest. He had also fixed the Ariel's position. If the transports were true to their rendezvous, they should show to the northwest in about an hour, and 2 hours after that Grimsholm should rise in the southeast.
"I have ascertained these facts," said Stephen, rehearsing them and showing the drawing. "They are corroborated by the Minnie's carpenter and boatswain, questioned separately. I do not count her second mate, for he has found means to be drunk, weeping drunk."
"It is very good as far as it goes," said Jack. "But I am not happy about the private signal. The Minnie has not been here for months, and it is very likely to have been changed."
"I abound in your sense, brother," said Stephen, "and I have been thinking. I have been thinking about Artemisia."
"Indeed," said Jack.
"Do not suppose I refer to Morselis's wife," said Stephen, raising one finger.
"If you mean the frigate, she is in the West Indies.
For it is Ligdamse's daughter that I have in mind, the Queen of Kos. As you will recall, she accompanied Xerxes with 5 ships, and she took part in the Battle of Salamis. Perceiving that the day was lost, and that several Athenians were in pursuit of her, she at once attacked a Persian ship. The Athenians assumed that she was an ally, gave over their pursuit, and so allowed her to escape. Now it occurs to me that there is a certain analogy here. Suppose the Minnie were to fly into Grimsholm, all sails abroad, pursued by the Ariel firing guns. Do you not think it would take? Do not you think that any error in the private signal would be overlooked in such a case, particularly as the Hamburg Jack was valid at the time of the Minnie's last visit?"
Jack thought for a while.
"Yes, I think it would," he said. "But it would have to be convincing. You tell me that a good many of the people on the island are seamen. It would have to be damned well done to convince a seaman. Still, I think it could be managed. Yes, I certainly think it could be managed. I like your scheme, Stephen.
I am heartily glad you approve it, and since you do, I shall offer some further observations. It would be the pity of the world if the Dutch and Baltic hands Sir James was so kind as to give us were to betray the stratagem by the propriety of their conduct, or the uniformity of their dress. They are neat, well-behaved men, accustomed to the discipline of the Royal Navy, and I see that they all wear much the same kind of purser's slops. I suggest they should exchange clothes as well as places with the minis, for what could be more authentic than the Danish garb itself taken from a Danish back? And then, so that there should be at least some familiar faces aboard, I suggest that her cook and carpenter should remain. They have both accepted a douceur in exchange for information, and they both stand to gain a considerable sum if all goes well.
"It shall be as you say," said Jack, draining the coffee-pot. "I will put it in hand at once."
He went on deck, and shortly afterward the minis began to come aboard in batches. When first they were told to strip, they looked very blank and apprehensive, and even when they were made to understand that this was an exchange, even when they were dressed again in the Ariel's slops, they remained exceedingly suspicious. Back in his cabin, with the ship's books before him, Jack was studying the record of his new hands when Hyde came in.
"I beg your pardon, sir," said he, "but the men say the Danes are lousy, and beg to be excused from putting on their clothes."
"They will be complaining of the weevils next," said Jack.
"I made that point, sir, but Wittgenstein, who speaks for them, said weevils were natural, whereas lice were not, being one of the plagues of Egypt, and therefore irreligious. They are afraid for their slops and hammocks, but very much more for their hair. They are extremely unwilling to have to cut off their pigtails, sir, and although they spoke respectfully, I believe they take it very much to heart."
"Let them be called aft, Mr. Hyde," said Jack.
And Stephen observed, "They do not distinguish between pediculus vestimenti, the body allows, and pediculus capitis, which infests the hair. Their pigtails are in no danger at this stage if they do not put on Danish hats." The hands came aft, the men condemned to wear the lousy clothes, looking grim and deeply displeased, the others amused and facetious. Jack took their mood at once and said,
"Ben, I understand you don't like lice. Well, I don't like 'em neither. But this is an urgent business we have in hand. There is no time to ship, wash tubs, and boil everything, and to get into Grimsholm you have to look like sloppy joes, not like man-of-war's men. I'm sorry for it, but there is nothing I can do. It is all in the line of duty. And you need not fear for your hair, so long as you do not put on their hats. A very learned gentleman has told me that these are innocent lice. They only go for your body, never for your pigtails. There is pediculo vestimento, and there is pediculo capito. Two quite different kettles of fish, vestments and caps. It is all in the line of duty, as I say, but it comes under the article of hard lying, and each man shall have 1 and 4 pence a day extra. What is more, the prisoners have been given new slops, and they will not lie in your hammocks, but berth in the hold on straw. You cannot ask fairer than that."
He knew he had satisfied them. Pediculo capito had turned the scale before ever he came to the hard-lying money.
"Dismiss the hands, Mr. Hyde," he said, "and let us carry on."
In the cabin once more he said,
"I intend putting Wittgenstein in charge of the Minnie to take her in, together with Klopstock and Haas as his mates. I do not contemplate sending any officers."
"Oh, sir," said Hyde, in a tone of deep distress. "I had hoped—"
"I know," said Jack, who understood his feelings perfectly. "But this is a special case. Her crew must look like common Baltic sailors, and our hands can wear what they please without infringing the rules of war. If they are taken, they are ordinary prisoners. If an officer is taken disguised, he is shot as a spy."
"Yes, sir, but I could be in my shirt sleeves with my uniform coat stowed away and my commission in its pocket. Sir, you know how hard promotion is to come by nowadays. A man has to jump into the mouth of a cannon and crawl out by the touch-hole, as they say. And even then he is not always noticed."
Jack hesitated. What Hyde said was perfectly true, and there was a moral obligation on a captain to give his officers their chance, usually in order of seniority. But in addition to the perfectly valid point about uniform, there was another he did not choose to mention. Hyde was a decent, conscientious young fellow, and very good at the shipkeeping side of his task, but he was no great seaman. His one idea of increasing speed was to pack on more sail, whether it pressed the ship down or not. He put her about in a poking, hesitant fashion, and once his unfortunate confusion of right and left had caused the Ariel to miss stays. If he had been sending an officer at all, Jack would have been far happier with Fenton, a natural-born sailor, but that would be seen as a direct slight. His hesitation did not last long. The issue was clear. No fine feelings must put the Enterprise and Stephen's life in hazard.
"I am sorry, Hyde," he said, "but you must look upon this as being in the line of duty, like the lice. I am sure you will have some other chance of distinguishing yourself presently."
He was not sure of it at all. He felt that his words carried neither conviction nor comfort, and he was glad when 4 sail of ships were reported on the starboard beam. They were far away, just topsails up, but their course was converging with the Ariel's, and until they could be certainly identified, he called Wittgenstein and his mates below, solid, middle-aged men with close on 100 years of service between them. He explained that they were to take the Minnie into Grimsholm, making all possible sail from the pursuing Ariel. They were to wear a Hamburg jack and Danish colours. They were to anchor off this island, showing them the drawing, and then put Dr. Maturin ashore. Dr. Maturin was to do all the talking, and they were to obey his orders to the letter. They were to speak no English in hearing of the island. They listened attentively, and he was particularly pleased to see how quickly and intelligently they took the point about sailing and behaving like merchant seamen. He was about to go over all these points a third time when Wittgenstein said a little testily,
"Yes, sir, I understand. I ain't no lubber. And by your good leave, I think we ought to go aboard now, promiscuous, to see how she handles."
Jack saw them pull across with their chosen band in their lousy coats, and he saw how quickly they threw off years of discipline, lounging about the deck, talking, leaning on the rail, chewing their quids and spitting, scratching themselves, hanging up their clothes here and there. The Minnie had never been what the Navy would have called a neat ship. Now she looked thoroughly low. By this time, the Ariel and the 4 ships in the northwest had exchanged numbers. As Jack had supposed, they were the transports escorted by Aeolus.
"It is damnably like counting your chickens," he thought,
looking at the troop carriers far over the water, and then southward towards the point where Grimsholm should heave up in time.
"I hope to God it may not bring ill luck."
7 bells in the forenoon watch had struck some while ago, and the sand in the half-hour-glass had nearly run its course. In spite of the general sense of impending crisis, for all hands knew very well what the Ariel was about, the ship was filled with the liveliest anticipation of dinner. Yet their usual cheerfulness at this hour was somewhat dampened by the knowledge that they were carrying a corpse. That unlucky thing. The young Frenchman had lost the number of his mess, and the sailmaker had been sent for to sew him into a hammock with 2 round shot at his feet. The officers took their noonday observation with particular care, a good observation that showed Grimsholm somewhat nearer than dead reckoning would have it. The glass was turned, the bell struck, and the hands were piped to their longed-for meal. By the time it was finished, the island would have nicked the clear sky. Shortly after that, Stephen would go aboard the Minnie, and the apparent chase would begin.
"Would it be improper to suggest our dining now?" he asked.
"Not at all," said Jack. "I will give the word at once."
He bent to the cabin skylight and hailed the astonished steward.
"Dinner on the table in 7 minutes. Caviar and the Swedish bread. Omelettes, beefsteaks, the ham, and what is left of the cold goose pie. And rouse out a bottle of champagne and 2 of the burgundy with the yellow seal."
In 7 minutes they sat down, Jack having given orders that he should be told as soon as Grimsholm came in sight.
"I have never eaten enough caviar," said Stephen, helping himself again. "Where did it come from?"
"The Tsar sent it to Sir James, and he passed a barrel on to us. Rum stuff. I dare say it was caviar to the Admiral, too."
This was his only small attempt at wit throughout the meal, and a little caviar was almost all he ate. His stomach was closed, and he could not even drink with relish. Stephen, on the other hand, downed his omelette and a pound of steak, finished the cold goose pie, and cut a slice of ham in what would ordinarily have been a very festive way for him. But the feast was no feast. The atmosphere was entirely wrong. They were polite to one another, and there was almost no real contact. It was as though Stephen were already gone, removed to another plane. It was only when they were drinking their port, and Stephen said how he wished they might have some music. In former voyages together they had played innumerable cello and violin duets, often in trying circumstances, that their old relationship came back to life.
"We might try glee," said Jack, with a poor smile.
But at that point a midshipman came to say, with the master's duty, that Grimsholm was sighted from the masthead.
"It is nearly time," said Jack. "We must be chasing long before they see us."
He reached for the decanter, filled their glasses, and raised his, saying,
"Here's my dear love to you, Stephen," and
the glass dropped from his hand and broke.
"Jesus,"
he said in a low voice, appalled.
"Never mind it, never mind it," said Stephen, mopping his breeches. "Now listen, Jack, will you? There are just three things I must say before I go aboard the Minnie. If I succeed, I shall hoist the Catalan flag. You know the Catalan flag, I am sure."
"I am ashamed to say I do not."
"It is yellow, with four bloody stripes down it, and if you see it, when you see it, you must send to the transports, which will obviously be out of sight of the island, to tell them to come in, and you must come in yourself at once, flying the same flag in some place of honourable distinction. I suppose we have one?"
"Oh, the sailmaker will run up half a dozen. Yellow Jack with stripes of the spare pennant."
"Just so. And I beg, Jack, that you will salute the fortress with all the guns proper for such a place, or even more, and that you will receive the commanding officer with the ceremony due to a nobleman."
"If he comes with you, Stephen, he shall have a royal salute."
Stephen crossed the lane of water, and they saw him hauled aboard the Minnie. The aerial signalled to the remote Aeolus to haul her wind, backed her topsails to give the Minnie 2 miles start, and at last the long hours of chase began. Stephen sat on an old kitchen chair by the mizzenmast out of the way. He had a satchel of papers on his lap, and he looked steadily forward at Grimsholm, fine on the larboard bow and growing larger. There was no point in preparing a careful, ordered statement. Everything would depend on the first moments, on the presence or absence of French officers, on his reception, and from that point on it would be an improvisation, a cadenza. He whistled the Montserrat Salva Regina, embroidering the theme. From the aerial's bows, Jack could see him plainly over the clear grey sea, even without his glass, a black figure sitting there. All too plainly. With this fine breeze well abaft the beam, the aerial had been overhauling the Minnie faster than was right this last half hour.
"Let her go and veer away,"
he said, and the spritsail course, its clews stopped, dropped into the sea over her blind quarter, acting as a drogue. It checked her speed, but not too obviously. She still gained a little, and 10 minutes later he said to the gunner,
"Very well, Mr. Nuttall, I think we may open fire. You know what to do. Take great care, Mr. Nuttall."
"Never you fear, sir," said the gunner. "I filled all our rotten old white grain. She's in no danger."
He fired. The ball pitched 200 yards short and 50 yards wide. The Minnie responded with a fitgallant weather stunsail.
"It must look right, though," said Jack.
"Never you fear, sir," said the gunner again. "Just you wait till the gun warms up."
The gun warmed up. The guns, indeed, for the aerial kept giving a slight yaw to bring first one chaser, then the other, into action, increasing her rate of fire, but diminishing her speed. The carefully chosen round shot cut up the water so close to the Minnie that once or twice the spray came aboard her. It was pretty practice, but it did not give the more experienced seamen in the aerial as much satisfaction as the sailing of the ship, the perpetual slight rising of sheets, the overpress of somewhat unbalanced sails, all the 100 capers her captain had learnt in the oceans of the world, everything to give the impression of great eagerness and of the utmost haste, without in fact gaining very much. The stroke that gave most pleasure was his order to set the main royal, a risky sail in such a breeze, even with sound spars.
"You are forgetting, sir," said Mr. Hyde. "The mast is sprung."
"I have that in mind, Mr. Hyde," said Jack. "A way aloft."
Mast, sail, and yard carried away after the first minute, a most spectacular sight from the land. And all the while Grimsholm came nearer, with the whole broad range of mainland shore that it guarded, miles of shoal-free coast with perfect landing places for an army, quite apart from the river port of Schweinau. For some time now the higher batteries had been in view, with the smoke wafting from their hot-shot furnaces, and in the transparent evening air good eyes could make out the red of the tricolour at the flagstaff. Nearer still lay the ill-defined limit of the battery's range of accurate fire. Wittgenstein evidently thought he was close to it, for he had already broken out the Hamburg jack. If the ruse had taken, if the watches on that hill had been deceived, the Minnie would pass the invisible frontier unharmed. If not, she would probably be damaged, possibly sunk. In his telescope, Jack could see the artillerymen busy about their batteries, and the smoke from the furnaces had increased.
"Surely to God they can reach this far,"
he said to himself, standing there on the forecastle with his hands clasped behind his back.
42-pounders, and with all that height!
Closer, closer still. And at last the long-expected flashes, the jetting smoke, and then the roar, deeper than the guns of any ship.
"Cast off the drag-sail! Stand by the starboard guns!" he cried,
and as he spoke the shot pitched, well grouped, and in a deadly true line, a cable's length beyond the aerial. Beyond the aerial, by God!
"Hard a-weather!" he cried. "Fire as they bear!"
The aerial turned on her heel so fast that the broadside went off as one gun. It should have been a harmless discharge for carronades at this range, but one freakish ricochet went home, piercing the Minnie's mizzen topsail. Jack had not time to notice that, however. He was wholly taken up with manoeuvring his ship out of the shocking fire that opened upon her. They had lured him in, well within the limit, and now the seas spurted white on either hand. Had he not had a fine brisk breeze and a handy crew, he must have been severely mauled, if not sunk, by the tons of red-hot iron they flung at him with such appalling accuracy. As it was, his sails were much tattered. A fire had started in the starboard head. One cutter had been destroyed, and the fore-topgallant mast wounded before he ran out of range. When he was quite sure that the upper batteries were not playing fox, but were in fact unable to reach him, he brought the aerial to the wind, told Hyde to set about knotting and splicing and bending new sails, and ran up to the maintop. From here he could see the whole bay perfectly well, the small islands at the bottom of it, the officers' houses and the barracks beyond, and halfway down the bay between the two flanking batteries the Minnie, slowly taking in her t'gallants as she glided towards the landing-place. A long, long pause while the work of the ship went on all round him, and the Minnie crept on. At last she rounded to and dropped her anchor some way from the shore. They seemed to be hoisting out a boat, but the declining sun sent such long shadows that he could scarcely make it out.
"On deck there!" he called. "Send up a telescope!"
Hyde brought it up himself.
"I can see them, sir," he said. "Just to the right, I mean to the left, of the large red house on shore."
Jack made no reply. He was hardly aware of the man's presence. There was Stephen, sharply focused in his glass, looking pale, but no paler than usual, sitting in the stern sheets while Wittgenstein pulled him towards a low jetty full of men drawn up in formal ranks that dissolved as Jack watched, leaving him in a state of the utmost doubt. He could not tell what it signified. In the boat itself Stephen sat quiet. The first signs had been favourable. The Minnie had not been fired upon. A voice from one of the flanking batteries, as they sailed close in, had called out to know whether they had brought any tobacco, and the Danish cook's reply had brought a roar of satisfaction. But these were only preliminaries. The real test lay 100 yards ahead, where those soldiers were waiting under arms. He had been weak enough to let himself be influenced by Jack's dismay at the childish omen, and by the young man's death. And although this was in some ways the easiest of his important missions, he had a premonition of disaster. He wondered at it, and at his own attachment to life. There were so many exquisite things in it. The smell of the clean sea, the golden light of the westering sun, to say nothing of an eagle soaring on the wind. His strength was not as great as he had supposed. These contradictions, this conflict between theory and practice, were turning in his mind when his whole spirit was jerked into the immediate present by the sight of the ordered ranks on the jetty dissolving into an ordinary crowd, no more. It had been a guard of honour. At the sight of a mere black coat coming ashore, it had been dismissed. Its function was to honour superior officers, not civilians. Wittgenstein spun the little boat about and made a sternboard so that it bumped against the jetty. Stephen stood up, hesitated, leapt for a bollard with a sergeant standing by it, and missed his hold. He fell between the jetty and the boat, and coming to the surface, called out in Catalan, "Pull me out, Helen Death!"
"Art a Catalan?" cried the sergeant, amazed.
"Mother of God, of course I am," said Stephen.
"Pull me out."
"I am amazed," said the sergeant, staring. But two corporals next to him flung down their muskets, leaned over, took Stephen's hands, and drew him up.
"Thank you, friends," said he, above a whole crowd of voices that wanted to know where he came from, what he was doing here, what news of Barcelona, Lleida, Palamos, Ripoll, what the ship had brought, and was there any wine. "Now tell me, where is Colonel Dollestrat?"
"He wants the colonel," said some.
Others said, "Can't he see him?" And the crowd parted, pointing. Stephen saw a small, upright, familiar figure.
"Padre!" he cried.
"Esteve!"
cried his godfather, raising his arms, and they ran together and embraced, patting one another on the back in the Catalan manner. This Jack saw among the lengthening shadows as the sun dipped over Sweden, but he could not make it out clearly for the crowd. Was it a greeting? Was it an arrest? A savage conflict? Nor could he tell what it meant when the whole group moved off to the large house painted red, though he stared until the red faded and the whole bay was filled with darkness, pricked with lights here and there and the old glow of the furnaces. The aerial stood on and off all night. He slept, or at least he lay down until the middle watch, the dead hours of the night, when he climbed slowly into the dew-soaked top and sat there, wrapped in his cloak, watching the stars and the lights of Aeolus and her transports that had orders to close within signalling distance after sunset. He was there still at the changing of the watch, when the master came on deck, and Fenton said,
"There you have her. Topsails and jib, course northeast by east, a half east, one glass, southwest by west, a half west, the other glass. Captain to be called if anything happens. Any lights or activity on shore?"
Then, in a lower voice, "He's in the main top." He was still there at the break of dawn, and as the light slowly mounted in the sky, he wiped the dew from his objective glass. He trained it first on the empty flagstaff, and then at the end of the bay. They had already cleared all the deck cargo off the Minnie, but that proved nothing. Soldiers were already moving about, and he heard a trumpet, high and clear, sounding a call he did not know. Gradually the red house resumed its colour, and presently he saw movement there, but too dim and far for any real distinction. Two bells, and they began to clean the decks below him. Up to the flagstaff again for the 20th time, and this time there was a group of men at its foot. He saw the rolled colours run up, a small black ball, hesitate at the top, and break out, streaming bravely southwards. Yellow, with four red strips. Joy filled his thumping heart, and he fixed it while he might have counted 10 to make certainty doubly sure. And as he looked, he saw the little group of men throw up their hats, join hands, and dance in a ring. He thought he made out cheering from the shore. Then, leaning over the rim, he called,
"Mr. Grimmond, take her into the bay."
He was so stiff that he went down through the lubber's hole, chuckling to himself as he did so.
"Lord, what a fat ass I've become."
On the quarter-deck he gave orders for the signal that should bring the transports in, for the Catalan flags that should adorn the aerial's mastheads, and for the coffee and Swedish bread that should still the grinding of his famished stomach.
"Mr. Hyde," he said, "I should like the ship to look particularly well today, if you please, fit to receive a nobleman."
He stood there, eating and drinking on a cleaned, dried patch of deck as the aerial repassed the dreaded limit of the great gun's reach, and he noticed that the officers looked uncommonly alert and grave, staring up at the great batteries.
"Pass the word for the gunner," he said after a while. "Mr. Nuttall, we will salute the fortress with 21 guns when I give the word."
He waited. Waited until the aerial was right between the two deadly flanking batteries far within the bay, and then said,
"Carry on with a salute."
Crisp and clear, at precise intervals it came, and the moment the 21st gun had spoken, the rocks on either hand, all the great casemates rising one above another overhead, vanished in a swirling cloud of smoke that dimmed the sky, and an enormity of sound, a universal roar. A cloud perpetually renewed, perpetually stabbed with flashes from every gun in Grimsholm, so that to the watching transports the whole island seemed to be in eruption. And this in a volume of sound so prodigiously great that the air, the sea, and the aerial trembled, and all her people stood motionless, stunned, amazed, deafened, until the last echoes rolled away, and they slowly realized that this was the returning of their salute, their peaceful welcome. Chapter 9. They had set out from Karlskrona on a dirty night, taking anxiety with them and leaving anxiety behind, an anxiety perhaps harder to bear, since the Admiral and his political colleague could do nothing but wait for the event of the exceedingly important transactions taking place on the far side of the Baltic. They returned in the early afternoon of a charming day, transports, prize, humbug and all, ghosting over a light green sea with barely a ripple on it. The warm southern air just far enough abaft the beam to allow all stunsails to stand, so that even the overcrowded, slab-sided troop carriers were a noble sight as they stood in, led by the aerial, in a perfect line astern, each ship a cable's length from her neighbour, with the Minnie bringing up the rear. And they found a different admiral, a younger, jolly man, no longer mordant or severe. The aerial had telegraphed her news from as far as signals could be made out. The flagship had been in a state of cheerful activity ever since, preparing for her guests, and the galley had been entirely taken over by the great man's cook and his mates.
"I knew it! I knew it!"
he said to Mr. Thornton, as they watched the aerial's boat come across.
"I knew the man! I knew what he could do! It is the finest thing! I knew it would be so!"
In the boat itself there was a grave silence. Jack was exhausted. Not only by his exertions when the Minnie was aground, by the sleepless nights, by the general wear of spirit during the transfer, and by the writing of his official report, but even more by Colonel Dollestret's extraordinary loquacity. The Colonel spoke no English, but he was fluent, dreadfully fluent, in French, a language in which Jack could at least listen, and in which, mindful of Stephen's warning that their guest must be handled with the greatest care, he had listened for hours and hours, doing his best to follow, and in the rare pauses contributing remarks that might perhaps be appropriate, and which he knew to be French, such as "Holy name of a dog," "Look me that," and "Blue belly." Hours in which Stephen had deserted him to swim in the newly recovered catalinity of the transports. Now, however, the colonel had fallen mute. Not only was he a dressy man, even in time of peace, but like many soldiers he believed that there was a direct relation between military worth and perfection of uniform. His own had suffered grievously from the Baltic damp. Its amaranth facings were now the colour of the mud at the bottom of a wine barrel, the lace was tarnished, the tassel of one of his boots was gone, and perhaps worst of all, his coat did not bear the marks of his present rank. The telescope had shown him the glittering array aboard the flagship, the scarlet and pipe-clayed marines, the officers in their number one cocked hats, the admiral glorious in blue and gold. And Stephen could see that he was uneasy in his mind, discontented, ready to take offence and to detect a slight. The brooding expression softened a little as the flagship began the salute, the purely personal salute this time, and Stephen saw his godfather counting the guns one after another. 13, and he looked quite pleased. 14, then the 15th due to a grandee or a full admiral, and the colonel nodded gravely. But his expression was still tense, and Stephen knew that it would not relax entirely until he had been welcomed aboard in a manner he thought appropriate, and until he had a good dinner with at least a pint of wine under his shabby sword belt.
"Should I embrace the Admiral?"
he whispered.
"I doubt it," said Stephen. "Lord Peterborough embraced my grandfather," said the Colonel, with a dogged look.
The boat hooked on. A moment's hesitation at the entering ladder, and they were in the midst of high naval ceremony, the wailing of boatswain's calls, the grind, stamp, and clash of marines presenting arms, and here was the Admiral, stepping forward with his hand outstretched to greet Captain Aubrey.
"I knew it!" he said. "I knew it would be so! I knew what you could do!"
"You are very good, sir," said Jack. "But I did little more than stand off and on. The credit," he added in a lower tone and with a significant look, "lies in quite another place. Now, sir, permettez-moi de... how shall I put it?"
"Présentez,"
suggested the Admiral.
"Thank you, sir. Présentez Don de la Strette, l'Amiral Samarez."
The Admiral swept off his hat. The Colonel spread his arms. After the very slightest pause, and to the unspeakable gratification of the quarterdeck, the Admiral embraced him on both cheeks, assured him with great truth and sincerity that he was very happy to see him aboard, and invited him to dinner. All this in a French somewhat more current than Jack's, and certainly less hideous than the Colonel's, for the Admiral was a Guernsey man. Yet although his tongue was French, his stomach was English, and the Colonel was faced with a dinner that would scarcely have been out of place at the Mansion House. Much of it was very strange to him, and much more was inedible for a Papist, this being Friday. But he was at the Admiral's right hand. He had precedence over a visiting Swedish officer of equal rank, and he steered his way between damnation and ill manners with great good humour, eating the root vegetables and green stuff untainted by flesh, concealing as much meat as possible, and staying himself with bread and wine, drinking glass for glass with the Admiral, though the Admiral was twice his weight. At the other end of the table, Mr. Thornton was telling Stephen of their anguish of spirit during the Ariel's absence, an anguish made all the more poignant by the arrival of a cutter at dawn with the intelligence that General Mercier had embarked in the Minnie.
"You talk of anxiety," said Jack, catching the word during a pause in the happy laughter either side of him. "But how would you like to be answerable day and night for a fragile, costly affair, the property of the King, perpetually at risk, in season and out? There is anxiety for you, I believe. We sea officers are much to be pitied."
"Hear him, hear him!" said his neighbours. "You young fellows may prate about your cares," said the Admiral, "but what would you say if you had a squadron on your hands? You cannot conceive—" "But I was forgetting, Aubrey. You had the Mauritius command, so you know what it is. Yet even so, you can have no conception of the jading worry of settling a Baltic convoy, 500 or 600 sail of merchantmen, even 1,000 just before the ice stops navigation, and almost nothing to convoy them with. No, no, you are very well as you are, going quietly about your concerns, gathering all the glory and most of the prize money."
Their respect for the Admiral was such that at any other time this might have passed— But now there was a general atmosphere of holiday and relaxation and cheerfulness, and the Admiral's good wine had been going round and round. Passionate dissent broke out. There was no prize money in the Baltic, and by the infamous new regulation that nothing was most scandalously divided. The captains had lost a whole eighth, and that eighth was most absurdly minced up and given to people who only played ducks and drakes with it, their share being so small, while the captains were reduced to abject poverty.
"Never mind, gentlemen," said the Admiral. "There is still glory to be picked up in the Baltic. Look at Aubrey here, as far as you can see him, for his fresh laurels. And in any case, who cares about filthy lucre?"
Some of the captains looked as though they cared very much indeed, and one even observed, "Non olet," in an undertone. But when the Admiral called down the table to his flag lieutenant, desiring him to "tip us, heart of oak," they listened to the young man's pure tenor with great approval as he sang, "Come cheer up, my lads, 'tis the glory we steer," and they joined in the chorus. "Heart of oak are our ships, heart of oak are our men, we always are ready, steady, boys, steady," with a fine growling roar, the last deep steady making the wine ripple in the decanters.
"We are singing about glory, sir," said the Admiral to Colonel de la Strette. "There is no better subject for a song," said the Colonel, "far more suitable than whining about some woman. I am a great friend to glory and to song. With your permission, I will sing you one about Lord Peterbugger and my grandfather when they took Barcelona together, the most glorious feat of united British and Catalan arms."
The song was quite remarkably well received, Indeed, the whole afternoon passed off very pleasantly, not only in the flagship, but aboard the transports, too, where ring within ring of Catalans danced the sardana on the forecastle to the sound of oboes and a little drum, while during the intervals the foremast hands showed them the finer points of the hornpipe.
"Lord Stephen," said Jack, when they had returned to the aerial, "I do not know that I have ever been so sleepy. I shall turn in as soon as we have unmoored."
"Surely we are not to set off again without a pause, for all love?"
"Eh?"
"Are we to set off at once? And on a Friday, too?"
"Yes, of course we are. You said yourself that the sooner they were repatriated, the better. The Admiral and the Politico quite agreed. So here it is in my orders. You had better look at them. They speak of you. And as for its being Friday, I don't believe in omens any more. Not after this last caper."
"We really might be a parcel of wandering Jews," said Stephen in a discontented voice. He took the orders and observed, "This seems to be a somewhat petulant insistence upon command and authority here. After so agreeable and, shall I say, matey afternoon, I should have looked for my dear Aubrey, rather than his cold and peremptory sir. And surely the whole tenor is arrogant, devoid of common amenity, calculated to arouse a spirit of indignant revolt. Sir, you are hereby required and directed to proceed without a moment's loss of time in His Majesty's ship under your command, together with the ships and vessels named in the margin, to Hanno Bay, where you will find a convoy under the protection of His Majesty's ships. I wish humbug had been among them. Such pompous, hectoring, tautologous, semi-literate stuff. You will leave the convoy when you reach the broad 14s, and make your way with the utmost diligence to the Bordeaux stream, where you may expect to find His Majesty's ship Eurydice for intelligence of the situation in the Bight of Biscay. Failing her, you will proceed to Santandero or Passages for the same purpose. And in all matters having to do with the landing of the Spanish troops, you will follow the advice of Dr. S. Maturin, who alone is to determine. Seek his guidance on the opportunity of Marquis of Wellington. Submit to his judgment. A man of any spirit would be more inclined to toss S. Maturin into the sea than to ask his advice after this. Spanish troops, forsooth." He had been aware for some time that Jack was asleep, but he maundered on until Hyde came in with the news that the aerial's signal to proceed to sea was flying aboard the flagship. Light airs all night, wafting the aerial and her charges south and westward through a gathering haze, her captain, as it were, stunned in the ultimate depth of sleep. Towards 5 o'clock he began to snore, a profound, deliberate, rhythmic sound that filled the cabin. "Ah, your soul to the devil, Jack," said Stephen, making an ineffectual lunge towards his cot. The snoring continued. Stephen thrust the wax balls deeper into his ears, but no bee had yet made the wax that would keep Captain Aubrey out, and presently Stephen left his bed in despair. A little after the changing of the watch, the noise stopped, and Jack sat up, wholly alive and conscious. It was not the noise of the ship's bell that woke him, for it had been tolling all night, ever since they entered the fog, with a musket shot every 2 minutes, nor the sound of the swabs and the holy stones, which were something of a lullaby to him, nor yet the light of day, there being so very little of it, but rather the working of some calculating machine within that had sensed the shifting of the wind, both in force and direction, and plotting these against the variations in the ship's course, with allowance for leeway and indraft, now informed him that they had opened Hanno Bay. He sat up, saw that Stephen's cot was empty, opened the slide of the dark lantern, looked at the telltale compass overhead, looked at the barometer, still sinking steadily, silently drew on his clothes and crept out, moving with great caution in case he should wake Colonel de Lestrette, who, the little ship being so crowded, slept in the dining cabin, an ever-present menace. On deck he could scarcely see beyond the bowsprit, but he heard the convoy at once, a remote braying of conches, the sound of bells, the occasional musket, and far off the thump of the escort's signal gun, the senior captain keeping his flock together.
He exchanged good mornings with the pilot and the officer of the watch, noticed that although the courses and topsails hung slack from their yards, the invisible t'gallants must be drawing, since the ship made more than steerage way, and looking at the logboard, saying,
"Well, Mr. Pelworm, how long do you think it will last?"
"Well, sir," said the pilot, "I reckon it will burn off with the sun, but I don't quite like the way the glass keeps dropping. I dare say it will start to blow from the north presently, and then back into the west. And with all this here convoy, the Langland's belt is none too wide."
Some freak of the air brought a passionate skipper's cry.
"If you foul my hawse, I'll cut your cable, you hulking Dutch-built bugger!"
as clear as if he had been only 100 yards off, instead of far along the bay. And immediately afterwards, Stephen's voice floated down from the upper regions to say that if Captain Aubrey chose to come up, he would see a most remarkable sight. He might make the ascent quite easily and safely by the ropes on the left, on the larboard side looking forward.
"What the devil did you let him get up there for?"
said Jack, frowning upon Mr. Fenton.
"He must be at the cross-trees!"
And pitching his voice aloft,
"Hold fast! Do not move! I am with you this minute!"
"I'm very sorry, sir," said Fenton. "They said they were just going into the top. Mr. Jagiello is with them."
"You might perhaps term it a hapax phenomenon," said Stephen.
"Hapax phenomenon,"
muttered Jack, climbing fast. They were not at the cross-trees. By some miracle they had managed to reach the t'gallant yard and to crawl out on it. There they stood, their feet upon the horses, their hands grasping various ropes, leaning over the yard, very much at their ease. Physically very much at their ease, with Stephen positively gay. Jagiello, however, was far less cheerful than usual.
"There!" cried Stephen, when Jack appeared in the frail t'gallant shrouds. "Are you not amazed?"
He pointed cautiously with one finger, and Jack looked out to the southwest. At this height they were above the low blanket of fog that covered the sea. Clear sky above, no water below, no deck even, but a smooth layer of white mist, sharply cut off from the clean air. And ahead, on the starboard bow and on the starboard beam, the surface of the soft, opaque whiteness was pierced by an infinity of masts, all striking up from this unearthly ground into a sky without a cloud, a sky that might have belonged to an entirely different world.
"Are you not amazed?" he said again.
Jack was ordinarily a good-natured man, but today he had not breakfasted, and in any case the sight of his friend trusting his life to an unstoppered signal halyard was more than he could bear. He roared,
"On deck! Belay the signal halyard! Belay everything that belongs to the main t'gallant!"
and said,
"Amazed and gratified, Stephen, leave go that rope, clap on to the yard, and come in towards the tie. I will guide your feet."
"Oh,"
said Stephen, giving a galvanic leap and throwing his arms about, "I'm not at all nervous. Now that I cannot see the deck, it is as though the height were abolished. I'm not at all nervous, I assure you. But tell me, have you ever beheld such a sight?"
"Not above a few 100 times, said Jack. "We call it the day blink. It often happens when the breeze lies just so, or dies away. It will clear as soon as the sun is well up. But I am grateful for having been called aloft before breakfast to see it again. Put your foot here, round the stirrup. You have fouled the stirrup. Your shoe is foul of the mouse. Mr. Jagiello, leave that becket alone. Stephen, give me your hand. Handsomely now, handsomely does it."
At this point Stephen dropped abruptly from the yard. Not perpendicularly, however, for Jack's powerful arm swung him inwards to the cap, while the shoe continued its free fall to the deck.
"Thank you, Jack,"
he said, gasping as he was settled on the cross-trees with a turn about his middle.
"I am obliged to you. I must have made a false movement."
"Perhaps you did," said Jack. "But what in God's name are you doing up here, anyway? Jagiello, leave that becket alone. You know I have begged you both not to go above the top."
"The fact of the matter is that Mr. Jagiello is in an embarrassing position."
"He will be in kingdom come if you don't leave go that becket. Mr. Jagiello, leave go that becket. Clap on to the robins with both hands and come into the big block in the middle."
"We could not discuss it on the deck. Since the people kept desiring us to move out of the swabber's way, so we went up to the top. But there again buckets of water were flinging about, so we climbed still higher. He has found a woman in his bed."
"Just so, just so," said Jack. "Mr. Fenton, secure the doctor's shoe."
"Yes, sir," said Jagiello, who had worked his way to the back brace and whose blushing face now peered down at them. "I found her there when I went to my cabin just now."
"What have you been doing all night?"
"I had been playing cards in the gunroom with the Catalan officers."
"And I collect that she is not wanted on the voyage?"
"Oh, no, sir. Not at all." It occurred to Jack that this was a very ridiculous place for a conference of such a nature, with the two landsmen poised in awkward postures between heaven and earth, and himself deprived of his breakfast. He called down,
"Mr. Fenton, send me up a couple of prime upper yardmen with a snatch block and line for a whip."
While they were coming, Stephen said in a low voice, "There, it is almost gone. And yet in its prosaic way this is almost as striking." The mist, lifting and dissolving with the first rays of the sun, showed 783 vessels, all merchantmen except for one frigate, the old Juno, three sloops of war, and a cutter.
"Never have I had so strong an impression of the vast magnitude of seaborne trade, of mercantile enterprise, of the interdependence of nations."
"There's our house," said Jack, nodding towards a town, now clear on the shore of the bay. "The lady will take her breakfast on dry land. Mr. Fenton, lower down the gig."
The top men came running up, one of them bearing Stephen's shoe. Jack cast a loop round his waist, made all fast, bade him hold on to the knot, called,
"Lower handsomely!"
And Stephen made his ignominious descent, as he had often done before. Jagiello followed him, and then Jack, broad grins on the quarter-deck and a lively air of expectation.
"Now, Mr. Jagiello," said Jack, "you must signify to the lady that she is to be over the side in 2 minutes. There is not a moment to be lost."
"If you please, sir," said Jagiello, blushing to the eyes, "I had rather not. It would seem so unkind, and it would take so very long. Tears, you know, and reclamations. Perhaps Mr. Pellworm would be so infinitely obliging. He knows her, and he speaks the Swedish. Mr. Pellworm is a married man."
"You are acquainted with the lady, Mr. Pellworm?"
"From afar, sir, from afar. I have seen the young person from afar. Who has not that has ever put into Karlskrona and attended the theatre? I may have spoken to her once or twice just to pass the time of day, as I did when she came aboard, but only when I was with officers, the young person being known to one and all, to all and sundry, sir, as the gentleman's relish, and I hope I know my station. Besides, I'm told she is now the governor's private piece, a singing harlot of enormous price, in the words of the poet. But if you wish me to turn her ashore, sir, I will speak to her now. Speak to her like a Dutch uncle."
"Aye, pray do, Mr. Pellworm," said Jack. "A man of war is no place for women."
Pellworm nodded, and he walked off with a heavy tread, composing his face into a severe, determined, and even brutal expression. A singing harlot she might be, but it was in a singularly harsh and unmusical voice that she addressed the aerial from over the water as the stolid, reliable, middle-aged forecastle hands rowed her ashore.
"What does she say?" asked Stephen.
"Loins as hot as a goat, heart as cold as a stone," said Pellworm. "That is poetry, too."
"It is not true. She knows nothing whatever about my loins, has never seen them,"
cried Jagiello from his lurking place on the far side of the mizzenmast. He added,
"I never invited her, and I begged her to go away."
"If only all these problems could be resolved so easily,"
murmured Jack, as he watched the gentleman's relish growing smaller and smaller.
"Mr. Fenton, we may edge down on the Juno and pick up the gig on the way."
Stephen glanced at him and at Jagiello.
"Poltroons," he said to himself, "scrubs."
And looking along the deck, he noticed that apart from a few grinning, ill-conditioned men and boys, most of the hands looked ashamed and concerned.
"It is a very curious thing," said Jack to Stephen over breakfast, "but I learned that Jagiello went ashore while we were aboard the Flag, and he had not been back above half an hour before three young women put off to the ship. Two were the Swedish Admiral's daughters, amazingly pretty, says Hyde, and the third was the relish, who kills at a mile. But what I cannot for the life of me understand is what they see in him.
"'He is a good fellow, to be sure, but he is only a boy. "'I doubt he shaves once a week, if that. "'And indeed he is rather more like a girl than anything else.'
"'So it seems was Orpheus, but that did not prevent women from tearing him limb from limb. "'His head, his beardless head, floated down the swift Hebrus, "'together with his broken lyre, alas.'
"'Oh, my God! Here is the Colonel,'
said Jack, "'grasping his cup and a piece of toast and hurrying on deck.'